Well, this is February 7th, 2010, and for my talk today, I'm going to, not sure what to call it, maybe we can call it a layman's look at acceptance and commitment therapy. This is a form of the third generation of cognitive behavioral therapy, or I'm not sure if I'm putting it quite right, but anyway, it's a form of psychotherapy that has a lot in common with Zen practice and actually sheds a lot of light on some of the difficulties that we encounter when we try to work with our own minds. I'd kind of gotten into this, I think, in a talk I gave maybe a couple years ago, and I thought maybe someday I'd come back to it, and for this talk, I am. And I think a good place to start is just to begin with the Serenity Prayer, which I could probably say for myself right now. It's, "Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." The trick, the big difficulty that we tend to have is knowing the difference. What things are subject to change and what things aren't. What things do we need to accept? How can we accept them? And what things do we need to get off our butt and do something about? So let me first just sort of sketch out this acceptance and commitment therapy. It's called ACT. That's the three-letter acronym. It's not called ACT. Every time in the book it says how to pronounce it, it references some paper that was written in 1999, you know, pronounced ACT, and then, anyway. academic writing drives me a little crazy, but we'll bear with it. This is what's part of what's called the third generation of behavioral therapy. So way back in the 50s or whenever, maybe in the 60s, probably in the 50s, it was all psychoanalysis, Jung and Freud and looking at the unconscious and finding the symbolic meaning of things that people do. And this was the way that psychiatrists, psychologists tried to get at helping people. And then along came behavioral therapy. You know, we all know about Skinner and the Skinner box. And basically, instead of worrying about what was going on in the mysterious human mind, especially the unconscious human mind, they targeted behaviors. So say you had an aversion to riding in an elevator, means could be found, perhaps by gradually acclimating you to get closer and closer to the elevator, I'm not sure, to enable you to do what you hadn't been able to do before. It's sort of what we could call first order interventions. And behavioral therapy actually had a better, more effective track record of anything that could be measured than psychoanalysis, which has never actually been shown, I don't believe, to be particularly effective. Although, you know, for given individuals, it may be extremely valuable. Anyway, out of that sort of worldview where the two great behemoths were behavioral therapy and psychoanalysis came this new field called cognitive therapy, where instead of just looking at people's difficulties with actions, started looking at people's difficult thoughts and the ways that people thought that handicapped them. You know, we can think of, we all have our pet thoughts that cause us difficulty. Probably the most famous is "I'm no good." It's always popular. "He's no good" is also a. you can pick and choose there. Anyway, cognitive therapy went after first order changes, let's say, in the way people thought. Let's replace. This is simplifying it and probably I'm insulting somebody who's a cognitive therapist, but let's replace bad thoughts with good thoughts. Think of Stuart Smalley, you know. I'm smart enough and good enough and doggone it, people like me. The power of positive thinking, we could say. But then what happened there is we had a sort of fusion of cognitive therapy and behavioral therapy, something called cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT, where the same sorts of techniques that have been used in behavioral therapy to modify actions could be brought into play to modify feelings and thoughts. And this actually has had a lot of success and has been the dominant form of therapy and the one that seems to work the fastest and therefore is the most reimbursable, and which certainly comes into play. And a lot of people have benefited from it. But what we have now is this so-called third generation. And here, instead of trying to work directly with our thoughts, and this may sound very familiar to you if you've been practicing Zen for a while, instead of trying to change our thinking, it's a question of changing our relationship to our thinking, changing the context. So where previously you might try to confront a thought like I'm no good and see the reasons why it wasn't really based in any kind of objective reality, it was just sort of a myth that you were carrying around, and then gradually might be able to see beyond that. In these newer forms of therapy, we're learning to not to take our thoughts at face value, to have a little bit of distance from our thoughts. There's a bumper sticker that I have sitting in my office that I'm meaning to put on the back of my car that says, "Why believe what you think?" It's all kinds of thoughts come into the mind, and as we all know, some of them are utterly ridiculous. And yet there are certain thoughts that we have, and without much questioning, we buy into them. And then the usual way of working on that is to try to fight them off. And we'll get into that in greater length as we run through the ACT model of psychotherapy. One of these new third-generation therapies is called DBT, which is dialectical behavioral therapy. That was pioneered by a woman named Marsha Linehan. I'm not going to get into this thing, but I just wanted to sort of give her a call out because this is a woman who practiced with a number of Zen teachers in the Yasutani Yamada line. And in fact, I looked at a few of her books, and one of them was dedicated to a Zen teacher named Pat Hawk, who's a Dharma heir of Aiken Roshi. And another was dedicated to a German teacher, I think Villegas Jaeger, who I believe is a Catholic priest who was sanctioned to teach by Yamada Roshi in Japan. And the two big things in DBT are what's called radical acceptance and skillful means. You know, I think she just stole it directly from Zen. Anyway, let's sort of dig into ACT. I am sure that, as usual, I have way more material than I can get through. So let me just sort of try to get my arms around this a little bit. And maybe the best place to start out is where I'm reading, by the way, from a book called Learning ACT, an Acceptance and Commitment Therapy Skills Training Manual for Therapists. And it's written by Jason Luoma, Stephen Hayes, and Robin Walser. The Stephen Hayes seems to be the main proponent of ACT therapy. Certainly I see him connected with almost everything I've seen written on it. Yeah, the book begins with a little quotation. "Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain," from The Wizard of Oz. And then he says, "The blessing and the curse of human existence is language. All of the processes in ACT flow from this insight and from the basic research that led to it." And of course, that's one of the wonderful things about some of these therapies is there's so much research that's been done to confirm what we may know personally from our own practice. He says, "From an ACT point of view, the primary source of psychopathology and human unhappiness is the way language and cognition," and by cognition we can just say thinking, "the way language and thinking interact with the circumstances of our lives to produce an inability to persist or to make changes that are in the service of long-term valued ends." Or you could say the primary source of our problem is getting tripped up by our own thinking. He says, "This kind of psychological inflexibility emerges when people use language tools in instances when those tools are not helpful or use them in ineffective or problematic ways. Language and logical or rational thinking are so useful in so many ways that it is easy to overextend their use into areas of living in which they are neither needed nor helpful." And then he gives an example of where language and thinking are quite helpful. He says, "Imagine you're in a room where all the exits are locked and you're offered one and only one chance to attempt to escape. So your task in this scenario would be to decide on your course of action. But you wouldn't be allowed to take this action until you had announced your plan. Now, under this circumstance, you'd probably put your mind to work and you'd evaluate your various options, their predicted consequences, and then you'd announce the one that was most likely to succeed. You might come up with all sorts of ideas, such as using a cell phone to call for help, kicking down the door, calling to your spouse in the next room, or breaking the window and jumping to the ground. Using only thought, you could consider the risks associated with each of these. For example, you might think, what if the door is too strong to be kicked in? What if nobody answers the phone? Using only your mind, you could fully formulate your plan and explain why this plan would be most likely to succeed." Okay. And of course he goes on to say, this of course offers us a huge evolutionary advantage. It's allowed human beings to take over the planet even though they are weak, slow, and poorly defended. True enough. Then he says, "But suppose instead of being trapped in a room, you are trapped in a feeling of intense anxiety or impending doom. Again, your task would be to find a way out. The same problem-solving abilities could be brought to bear that would provide solutions. For instance, take a tranquilizer, suppress the anxiety, engage in self-injury, have a drink, and would deliver possible outcomes, such as escaping from the feelings. But this time, however, ACT research suggests that the very solution designed to solve the problem would become the problem. You would now be engaging in a core pathological process known in the ACT model as experiential avoidance." The work on which this book is based makes it clear that the same things that work well in the external world can easily create harm when turned towards the internal world. It gives another example. If we don't like peeling paint, we can scrape the wall and put a fresh coat on. But if we don't like thinking of a past trauma and try to scrape it away, we may make it more central, more salient, and more influential. If we fear a future drought, we might save water to quench our future thirst. But if we fear future rejection and try to make sure no one will ever hurt us in that way again, we may detune our relationship or avoid making commitments and thus amplify the role of rejection in our lives. So basically that's the problem. We try to fix what's wrong with us by mucking around with our thoughts and our emotions and trying to control them. And in the process, we make a mess of it. We make things worse. So he moves now into the... when I say he, of course, this is a book written by three people, and one of them at least is not a he. So they move into the ACT model of psychopathology, what's wrong with us psychologically. And there's six different things that they mention, way too complicated for me to get into. There's a lovely little hexagonal graph with lines running from each point to every other point, and a big blob in the middle called psychological inflexibility. But two of these points seem to be the most important, and I often see them talked about alone, so I'm going to really look at those two. And the first one is this term that we just used, experiential avoidance. Another word for it or phrase for it is experiential control. And basically what this is the attempt to control or alter the form, frequency, or sensitivity of internal experiences, by which he means thoughts, feelings, sensations, or memories, even when doing so causes harm to our behavior. And of course, their theory about why we do this comes from their theories about how language insinuates and thinking insinuates its way into every aspect of our lives. Okay, he says, let's begin with the process of avoiding a negative thought. Suppose it is very, very important not to think something. Deliberate attempts to control the emergence of this thought invoke the verbal rule, do not think X, whatever X may be. However, specifying X will tend to evoke X. Not thinking of a lake evokes thoughts of a lake. Not thinking of a baby evokes thoughts of a baby. This happens simply because these verbal events are related to actual events, and because some of the properties of these, of the actual events, transfer to the verbal event. That is, when you hear the word baby, you may see an image of a baby in your mind. So the same thing tends to occur with emotions. Usually anxiety is said to be something to avoid because of the long list of undesirable consequences you may think, I will make a fool of myself, or I will go crazy, or I will have a heart attack, or I will not be able to function. But the natural emotional response to such consequences includes, of course, anxiety. So what we start out with is a problem. It could be anxiety, it could be physical pain, whatever it is, by directing our thinking towards it, we enlarge it. Give another example. Say there's somebody that you have a bad relationship with, a great deal of difficulty with. The more you think about that person, the worse it is. They don't even have to be in the room to bother you. Mm. You can sit alone in your own room thinking about that horrible person and the horrible things he's done and the horrible qualities that he has and how horrible he made you feel. And of course, you're doing to yourself what you feel he or she has done to you. So saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, when you hold a resentment, you're letting somebody live rent-free in your own head. And yet, you're bothered by it, so it seems you need to do something. That's the problem. We've got this wonderful tool, which is thought. And when we have difficulties, we employ our number one tool. It's like the saying to someone with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And sometimes what they're calling experiential avoidance can work a little bit, they say, sad to say, over the short term. For instance, a person handling anxiety by drinking may, quote, get away with it for years before the solution becomes its own problem. A person avoiding fearful situations may feel relieved in the moment and only gradually notice the constriction of his or her life space. And here again, we're sort of touching on this phenomenon of psychological inflexibility. When you find yourself not doing things because you're trying to avoid a bad feeling, you've limited yourself. And that's the great danger with what they're calling experiential avoidance. Our lives become very circumscribed. I can't do that because it's going to cause me physical pain, or it's going to cause me emotional pain. I'm not ready to do that yet. We're always saying, as soon as I can get the courage or get over my bad feelings, then I'm going to do the things I value, whatever it is. Of course, it doesn't work that way. You can lie in bed for hours waiting for the inspiration to get up, or you can just get up, which works quite well. One of the problems they point out is that in our culture, the general social focus, this is here I'm quoting, is on feeling good. Sometimes it goes further than this. Not only should we feel good, but we're entitled to feel good. Avoidant solutions, such as alcohol, drugs, and mindless sex, are modeled in television shows, commercials, and other media, and a general feel-goodism is promoted by the culture. Sadly, perhaps, feeling good is often at the very heart of the mental health model. We go to a therapist because we want to feel good. Anthony DeMello, who I've brought in a number of times, did a lot of work as a therapist and commented that it sometimes bothered him that in a way, by helping the client to feel good, he was removing the impetus to real spiritual growth. You know, there's always that danger that if we're just trying to take care of the symptoms, I just want to get a little relief here, we are once again engaging in experiential avoidance. And in one way or another, we're constricting our lives. Says, we diagnose disorders based upon the presence of particular configurations of private events and experiences, that is, internal events. For instance, self-critical thoughts, suicidal thoughts, and feelings of fatigue are part of depression. And then we construct treatments designed to eliminate these symptoms, ostensibly with the goal of returning the person to good health. Unfortunately, all of this has the risk of feeding the message of feel-goodism. This is sort of like the difficulty we have in practice. We're hoping to become more calm. We're hoping to be free of thoughts, more responsive. But if we turn a portion of our attention to seeing how that's going, if while we're sitting, we're monitoring our sitting and seeing, you know, how free am I of thoughts, that's a thought. This is the basic paradox that we're addressing. The solution is the problem. Besides this concept, well, let me just say a little bit more about experiential avoidance. What we're trying to avoid, there are two things you can try to avoid. One is to avoid direct physical pain. And then, and you can do certain things. You can, you know, make sure that you don't fall off the ledge and you don't bump your head and take normal physical precautions. But then there's attempting to avoid the bad feelings that pain brings up. And so they make a distinction between what they're going to call clean pain, which is straightforward physical sensation, and dirty pain, which is all the horrible feelings we have when pain is inescapable. And actually, there's a second workbook here that deals solely with people with physical pain. And it's called Living Beyond Your Pain, Using Acceptance and Commitment Therapy to Ease Chronic Pain. And this one is written by Joanne Dahl and Tobias Lundgren. I think they're both Scandinavian, and it's forward by our friend Stephen Hayes. And let me just dig in here. They say about these two kinds of pain, and I think this is probably going to be familiar to a lot of people, certainly anybody who's been to Sesshin. It says there's a kind of dividing line between where pain ends and the suffering your pain causes you begins. This same line marks the difference between the aspects of your pain experience that you have control over and the ones you don't. ACT draws this line between the physical pain you feel, of course, there you have no control over it, and the way pain is interrupting or inhibiting your life, understanding them as two different kinds of pain. We call the first one clean pain. It's an immediate, simple physical sensation that tells us something is wrong. An aching back, sore wrists of carpal tunnel syndrome, tender spots, an old ankle injury that flares up regularly, these things are all clean pain. What we call dirty pain is something quite different. That's all the reactions you have to your physical pain. Dirty pain is the things your mind tells you about your physical pain. It's the epithets that run through your head when you do something that puts you in pain. It's the avoidance behaviors you engage to keep yourself from feeling pain. Dirty pain is your attempts to relieve yourself of pain where relief may not be possible. Clean pain is just pain. Dirty pain is all the stuff that goes along with your pain. That's where pain ends and suffering begins. It's not just that pain is inescapable. Well, we could say it is that pain is inescapable. Pain includes our feelings of the moment. If you have a feeling of emptiness or a feeling of anxiety, that really is simple pain. The thoughts that bring it up, this is dirty pain. You can't get rid of the reality of this moment. And if you turn your efforts to doing that, you tend just to stir it up. I remember for so many sesshins, I struggled with pain in my legs. And a round would begin, and everything would be okay. And then at a certain point, I would think about the fact that towards the end of the round, I would probably be having a lot of pain. And immediately, the pain would be there. It was magical. It was truly magical. And every now and then, you know, over time, I would successfully sink into the pain. Roshi Kaplow was always telling us just to put our mind right there where the pain was and become one with it. And every now and then, that would magically work. But I was always trying to somehow manipulate that pain. It gets at one of the real paradoxes here, which is acceptance is, no doubt about it, the solution to what we're calling experiential avoidance. But if you use acceptance to try to make things better, it really is just another form of trying to fix the problem. I feel I'm not doing this justice, but it's the same problem that we have in practice when we use practice as a technique to get a result. The minute Zazen is in the service of some outcome, it's not pure Zazen. It's one of the reasons why koans are so effective, is that if you really, sincerely get into the questioning, get into the inquiry, you're out of that stupid loop of trying to manipulate your mind to get into whatever you think is the desirable state. It's also why practice is so bedeviling, because when you do get a so-called good result, immediately the mind turns to wanting to try to recreate that. What did I do that? How can I do it again? Now I've got the way of doing it. I'll never have this problem again. And then sure enough, the beauty of Zazen is that stops working and you're thrown back again, the need to rely on nothing, which is very reliable. Well, maybe that's enough about experiential avoidance for the time that we have. Let me turn to the other biggie in his in their six-axis model, which is something called cognitive fusion. This is really a wonderful concept. You could say that cognitive fusion is basically mistaking the finger pointing to the moon for the moon. It's a well-known concept in Zen. So he says, in general terms, cognitive fusion refers to the tendency of human beings to get caught up in the content of what they are thinking, so that it dominates over other useful sources of behavioral regulation. That is, things that you could actually do. By thinking, we mean it. This is getting a little too wordy here. It says the word fuse comes from a word that means to pour. Metaphorically, it is as if the content of thinking and the world about which we are thinking are poured together until they are one, in much the same way that lemons, water, and sugar can together become lemonade. But when thinking and the world about which we are thinking are treated as one thing, thinking habits can dictate how we react to the world, and we can miss that the structure being imposed on the world by thought is an active process. That is, it's something that we're doing. We're creating our own world through our thoughts and then thinking that it's something outside of us. It says, imagine that thoughts are like a pair of sunglasses you forgot you were wearing. They color your view of the world, and you are unaware it is being colored. You are dealing with the world as it is directly experienced to be, and missing that you are languaging about it. For example, when people with obsessive compulsive disorder think, if I don't wash my hands, my family will be contaminated, they can become so focused on the world colored by that thought that they are seemingly not interacting with a thought at all. They are dealing with contamination and its consequences, that is, that their family might die, and not with a thought. So this happens to us all the time. We react to a thought as if it was something real, something objective in the world outside ourselves. As verbal cognitive constructions substitute for direct contact with events, we forget we are interacting with thoughts rather than with the real thing. The past can present itself as if occurring now, although it is dead and gone. The future can become present here and now, even though it is there and then. The present moment is lost to the mind's focus on the past and the future. We are constantly interacting with the world as cognitively organized without noticing that we are constantly organizing it. And it's maddening that people feel that they're dealing with reality. If you ever tried to give somebody advice who's caught up in a persistent and seemingly totally justified thought, you know how difficult it is to let go. to let this go. And that's a lot of what this form of therapy is involved with, is just getting people to have a little bit of distance from their thoughts. There are a lot of techniques that we'll hopefully get into. But first, let's look a little bit more about this whole phenomenon of cognitive fusion. Here he says, they say, unfortunately, this context of literality, and there, by that they mean saying things like, I stayed in bed because I was depressed, tends to support the idea that reasons are literal causes. For instance, we think depression caused staying in bed. In effect, verbally constructed why answers are considered real simply because the verbal community, that is everybody we know and talk to, treats them that way. Reasons that begin as explanations for behavior later come to exert control over our behavior because of this social context of reason giving. Our lives become entangled with an ever larger network of verbal formulations as every aspect of our lives is analyzed and categorized. Hiroshi Kaplow used to say, the reasons that people give for what they do are never the real reasons. It's extremely helpful when you find yourself trotting out a reason for something you've done, to take it with a grain of salt, just to see it as, you know, we basically fill the space of not knowing why we do what we do with our reasons. I was so upset about my mother that I was unable to do such and such. For example, meetings are missed because, quote, they were forgotten, or tasks are avoided because, quote, we are afraid. This formulation is rarely challenged. It seems almost rude to ask, why did you forget? Or why didn't you just feel the fear and still do it? I can't do it because I'm afraid. I can't do it because it makes me feel bad. This is what closes us down. This is what makes us unable to respond with our whole being. It's not that we have to stop feeling afraid. We just have to stop letting it dictate what we can and can't do. We just have things so backwards. We're trying to get our head on straight and then do the right thing, whereas what we need to do is do the right thing, and the head will follow. If it doesn't follow, who needs it? They make a point somewhere here that acceptance doesn't mean a feeling. You know, a lot of people think acceptance means I have this open, expansive feeling and I'm, you know, in love with the whole world, the good, the bad, the entire thing. Acceptance means we do what we need to do. Acceptance means I feel shitty, and now I'm going to do my exercises. If you wait to feel good, you're going to spend your whole life waiting. If you try to make yourself feel good, you're going to spend your whole life trying. There's another saying in AA and Alcoholics Anonymous, don't try harder, try different. I could almost say, don't try harder, try not trying. There's a nice metaphor for this this whole business about bringing acceptance to bear on our lives and on what we feel are our problems. I'll just summarize it here. Here they're dealing with the question of pain, and it says what they're saying is it's like you have two dials. You've got a dial that's supposed to change the physical pain, the pain you're experiencing, and you have a dial that controls your acceptance. You know, more acceptance, less acceptance. The dial that controls the pain doesn't work. The pain changes regardless of you turn the dial up, you turn the dial down. Sometimes the pain seems to follow along, other times it doesn't. It's basically just a dummy dial that's been stuck there for you to play with. The dial that actually works is acceptance. The degree to which you can make peace with the fact that things are the way they are, that right now my leg hurts. When you do that, it ceases to be a problem. The leg still hurts, but it's not the problem that it was when you're busy running away from it, because running away from it makes it bigger. You're feeding the monster. Of course, physical pain can stand for any number of unpleasant internal experiences. Maybe anxiety is a good example. If you try to avoid anxiety, everybody feels anxiety at one time or another, unless you're very strangely constituted, in which case you probably have other problems. Everyone is going to feel anxious. But what do you do when that feeling comes up? The primary normal reaction is to try somehow to keep that unpleasant, and it is a very unpleasant feeling, keep that unpleasant feeling at bay. Stuff it in some way. And of course that makes you anxious. And a lot of people are caught in this trap. The acceptance approach is to actually welcome it, to actually experience it. There's a metaphor they use of somebody in quicksand. So you're stuck in quicksand. If you struggle to get out, you get more and more mired in it. The only way, what you actually should do, and there are books about how to survive any catastrophe, and they cover quicksand. Apparently what you do if you suddenly find yourself in it, and hopefully this will save someone's life here, is you simply lay out on your back flat. So as much of your body is in contact with the quicksand as possible. And then you float on top of it. It's the same with these internal feelings and negative thoughts that we're running from. If we simply turn our attention to them and can see them dispassionately, they lose a lot of their power. It can get to a point where you can actually welcome some of your old negative stuff, because it gives you a chance to really shed some light on it, to see it. It's such a different approach to take than the feeling of, oh my God, I don't ever want to feel that again. You know, to be able to honestly say, I'm willing to feel that way again. I would like the opportunity to feel that way again. Two totally different ways of relating to the same thing, with two totally different outcomes. But of course, I have to give that warning again. If you're using that as a technique, to the extent that you're using that as a technique, and you will, you know, we're suckers. To the extent you use that as a technique to try to manage the pain, it's not going to work so well. But the minute you have genuine interest, the minute you drop your demands, then things can open up and there's room to move. Basically, then you have what they're calling psychological flexibility. A lot of possibilities open up. There's so many areas when I find this stuff actually kind of exciting, because there's so many areas I think most people must have where we've just been beating our heads against a wall again and again and again, trying the same thing and getting the same results. And the other wonderful thing about this whole model is that it's so attuned to Zen practice. I'm not even going to have time to get into what they say about cognitive diffusion, but if the ability to let thoughts pass through the mind, seeing them as clouds moving through the mind, if that's not cognitive diffusion, I don't know what is. One of the beauties of beginning Zen practice is being suddenly made aware that our minds are a riot of thoughts. People are often quite dismayed when they first start to sit. They'll come and say, you know, that there's a big problem with me. I'm thinking all the time. Sometimes they think that meditation has caused this problem. It's patient practice, sitting over time, day after day, sitting for longer periods at Sesshin, has an enormous power to dissolve our attachment to our thoughts. You need to be clear about it. You need to step back from time to time and see where you may be stuck, what you may be buying into, because you can do Zazen and hold on to certain habitual thoughts and never question them. For instance, the one I mentioned early on, I'm no good. There are plenty of people who are doing Zazen round after round, and they're entertaining this thought of I'm no good and trying to deny it or buying into it and forgetting as just another thought. It's just another thought. It's no more substantial than your thought that there's a bird outside the window. How often have we heard Roshi say, they're just thoughts? We get fooled into thinking they're more than thoughts because they seem to be so central and so important. Thoughts about the self, which is another one of their six axes that we're not going to get into. Thoughts about me, they seem so important and so meaningful. But it's just a tar pit. It's just a place to get stuck. Once you can see that thoughts don't need to determine behaviors, I can feel frightened and still make that phone call. I can feel tired and still get up, come to the morning sitting. A little pitch for the morning sitting there. It's very liberating. And the other thing you find is we always have this idea that any given thought is going to persist. We have this sort of magical belief, I feel this way and I'm always going to feel this way. Once you find the courage, God grant me the courage, once you find the courage to do things, to feel bad and still do the right thing, you find out those thoughts are fleeting. They don't last. I woke up in bed, I felt really, really tired, I got up anyway, 5 minutes later, what was that about? How many times has that happened to you? Pay attention to that. We have this idea that we think something and then we do it. And actually that's something that's been experimentally disproven. If you decide to jump off a diving board, before you make the decision to jump, your body is already initiating that activity. They can actually measure it. You're tensing the muscles in preparation. Then you have the thought, I'm going to jump, and then you jump. You're just this unnecessary kibitzer, self-important parasite. Well, I feel like this talk has been a little formless, a little form to it, but it's such a big topic and there's so much that you can say about it. And I just want to, one final thing, just say a little thing about therapy itself. You know, when the center began, I think Roshi Kaplow felt that if somebody wholeheartedly practiced Zen, they really wouldn't need to go in for therapy. Why would you need to do that? And probably it's true. If anybody here is fully and completely enlightened, you probably don't really need therapy. But it's just so easy to be fooled. The ego is so wily and clever, and we have so many addictive behaviors and things, you know, bad ways of reacting to things are so pervasive and so supported by the culture and everyone. It's just, if you have a problem that therapy can address, it can work very well with Zen practice. The two are not contradictory. And, of course, this is a point that Bodhin Roshi has made quite forcefully, and he himself underwent some therapy early on when he was first beginning to teach here, and had, you know, what he felt were really, really excellent results. I have to say, for myself, I really was stuck in a difficult place in practice, in my relation to practice, and my desire to be a better student, and my fear that perhaps I was a pretty lousy one. And that really never got defused until I went into treatment for alcoholism. And out of that, it was life-changing. So I have tremendous respect for getting in and doing this kind of direct work, using words and concepts to get at some of this. But it is a tricky area, and I think it's really sort of exciting that therapy and Buddhist practice have sort of lent each other something. And you one of these books I read began with the statement that life is inevitably suffering. I think we know that in Zen Buddhism. So anyway, it's I hope other people got something out of this, and there's a little bit of time. If anybody has a question or a comment, fire away.
John, just to emphasize what you said just now about getting into therapy when needed. I think that's especially true from my experience with Zen practitioners who, as John Wellwood, a psychologist, has put it, tend to use what he calls spiritual bypassing, you know, which to use practice as a cover, as a defense to genuine experience. I mean, we have the teaching that the Buddha said that, you know, everything, we have this full range of experience as human beings, but a lot of us come to practice and tend to want to only feel that happiness or that enlightenment and not open up to their full range of experience. And practice can act as a cover to that full range of experience if we allow it to.
Yeah.
So practice can work into the service of repression a lot of the time, and we don't even know it. So
yeah.
Having the courage to see beyond that, practice can help us become aware of certain things, but not maybe have the tools to deal with them.
Yeah, I think any tool you can pick up that helps you to open up more fully is great. You know, it's just it's there's a lot in Zen that deals with, you know, opening up completely to your life. It's not that Zen doesn't address this, but we have a way of taking something and turning it to our own ends. I'm sure it's one of the reasons why over the years you read about periods when Zen flourished and other periods when it went into, you know, sort of decay. Because human beings look for ways to take the easy way out and to stay comfortable. Yeah. Yeah, Dwayne.
So if you think you're a nail, everything you see looks like a hammer.
If you're a fearful nail, it might just look like a board that needs to be punctured.
So, John?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
How would you know if you're tricking yourself? What would be some signs?
Yeah, well, if you find that you're not responding completely to your life, if you find that you're, you know, excluding things, or if you're getting feedback from other people too, you know, it's the beauty of being married is all the wonderful feedback you get. Or the beauty of living in a community like this. I mean, people here in training get a lot of feedback, and not all of it positive by any means. Jerry.
I was going to just make a comment. Marsha Linehan does acknowledge Zen openly in her workshops and in her training.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to say she didn't. Yeah. And the fact that she dedicated both those books to her Zen teachers, yeah.
She also has her own little sessions.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah, one thing I didn't say about DBT is I understand it is the only form of therapy that's been shown to have any positive results on people with borderline personality disorder, which I'm told is the disorder that no one wants to touch. Scott's told me about a friend of his who's a therapist who said, you know, it's just you can't do anything with those people. That's basically the way it's a lot of people feel about it. But she's gotten results, and some of it has been well quantified by measures such as whether they've attempted suicide or not, or succeeded or not. And so that's the great thing, is, you know, the wonderful thing about our scientific world is that we can actually have ways of showing that stuff works or doesn't work. Of course, we can only show that with the stuff that we can measure, and we often get in trouble by excluding things that can't be measured, but it seems to be very helpful here.
Julian, going back to Paula's question, though, about what, you know, what you said is really important, I think. How do you know if you're fooling yourself? I think in terms of what I've heard is that word, for me, what has a lot of power is that word incongruence.
Mm-hmm.
When our experience is not in congruence, or it doesn't match up with what we think, or what we feel doesn't match up with what we experience, or, you know, there's some kind of disconnect, or it's like puzzle pieces, and they don't quite fit together.
Yeah.
When life feels like that to us, then something's wrong. And whether we use Zen practice or therapy to get at that root and find out what's wrong and how they can fit together, that's the important thing.
Yeah, the one place where you see a lot of incongruence is your interactions with other people. When you think a conversation went one way and they didn't. Yeah, what's something's there, yeah.
One of the things that I find sometimes confusing with psychotherapy and Zen practice or trying to work on yourself or understand what's going on is that people will say, or you'll think, this is my karma, or maybe I'm burning off something from a past life, or, you know, do you know what I'm saying? It brings in a kind of ambiguity.
Yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot of virtue to dwelling in thoughts about, you know, this is karma, or here are the reasons why. It's basically, this is reality right now. This is what I'm dealing with. And, you know, the reasons why these things happen, that's, you're kind of getting secondary.
But wouldn't that have something to do with the acceptance?
It might help people accept. I think people who have a deep belief in karma, it makes it easier for them probably to accept painful experiences.
But then wouldn't that sometimes confuse when to act and when not to act?
Well, whether it's your karma or not, you can still, I mean, number one, it is your karma. You know, it happened. But whether, you know, there's some, you know, you did something in a past life, let's say, or not, you still have the present situation. There's it's never a call for passivity or inaction. Yeah.
The point of passivity, could I just say that Marshall Linehan coined the term radical acceptance partly to get over the image of acceptance being sort of rolling over and playing, you know, just anything's okay, you know, sort of passive thing. Radical gave it sort of an edge. Now what a lot of therapists are using instead of the word acceptance is the word willingness.
Right, right.
Which is a wonderful act of, you know, moving into the present, accepting it without rolling over and playing dead.
Because you don't like to do that, do you? Okay, good place to stop.